You're listening to Book Night on Cambridge 105.
Yes, hello, welcome to Book Night with me, Lee Chambers, and Alex Rouget. And our studio guest today is André Mongeau, who's a novelist, short story writer and poet. We've also got interviews with best-selling author Mena Van Praagh and an interview with K.D. Trevelyan from Cambridge Writers. They've just published an anthology of short stories. Alex, I know the answer to this, but do you read many short stories?
I do. I read quite a few, actually. I mean, I think I'd say I started reading them because I wanted to learn how to write them, and I would always have gone for a novel if I was going on holiday, if I was going to, you know, really wanted to read some fiction that was that I could really immerse myself in. But now I'd say that was completely changed, and I love short stories, and I will buy a collection of short stories just for pleasure, just to read, because I love them so much, and I think it's such a shame that they're not more widely read. How about you?
I don't read that many, I'm afraid.
So you're one of the culprits, you see.
Yeah. I like a novel. There's something that the length of a novel and the depth of a novel, and I know you do get all that in a short story, and I have read a few, but they are the big names, you know, the sort of Alice Munro and Ali Smith, and I know that you read much more widely, don't you? I mean, who's your favourite short story writer?
Well, I've got a sort of change who I love. At the moment, I'm completely obsessed with Laurie Moore, and I just can't stop reading her. And, you know, I've been through my Alice Munro phase. I've been through phases of reading Hemingway, Chekhov, and all of those. And also more contemporary writers like Anne Enright. But I think what I think about it is that people always say about reading, there's so little time in so many books. And so, there are times in your day where you don't have time to read a novel or to start reading a chapter. You don't want to just read part of a chapter. So why not sit down for 15 minutes and read, you know, an amazing author, the sort of authors that you can read, like Hemingway and Chekhov and Mansfield and all those people, and get a sort of little shot in the arm of literariness, which I don't think is a word, but I'm going to use. So I think at this point we'll bring you in, André.
Hello.
Obviously, you love short stories because you write them. But,
yeah.
Do you get frustrated that people don't read them enough?
Yes, I think it's a bit of a thing that comes from publishers too, that they push novels. And I started off as a novelist and always believed I was a novelist and wanted to write novels. But I kind of evolved into writing short stories and poems, and they're extremely satisfying to read and to write. And I now have read a lot more short stories than I did in the beginning when I was setting out to be a writer, because they are the hardest form. There's no doubt about that. I mean, a novel is baggy and capacious, and you can, in one sense, start off throwing everything you want into it. There's no way you can do that with a short story. You know that from the start. Obviously, you can make it bigger and cut back. But my challenge now is to write stuff that is extremely compressed. Because I started off writing novels, I am quite capacious, and I like to throw a lot in and establish characters, locale and background. But you don't really have time to do that in a proper short story. So I'm still, I guess, caught between the two, and I write something that's quite like a novella, really.
Can I just establish what a short story is? When we say short story, what kind of word length are you talking about?
Oh, well, I mean, how long's a bit of string? And we have this argument when we talk about what is a poem as well. I mean, it's just, you could go on all day, couldn't you? It probably moves from things that are now called flash fiction, which I've only come across in the last year or two, which is literally 250 words or a page or less than a page, which I think is far too compressed, and it's a bit of a game, really. I would say a short story is, 5 to 10 pages, and sometimes it can go up to a novella length, which is probably 30 pages. But anything over that, I think you are beginning to get into what is effectively a novel or a chapter of a novel.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And then there's the whole sort of range of linked short stories as well, where people perhaps use the same character. I think I asked the short story writer Colette Paul, is there ever a sense that you don't want to let go of a character, and so they re-emerge in another story?
No, I haven't found that, although there are some collections I've read. I remember The Consul's File by Paul Theroux, which is very satisfying because characters wander in and out, become the main character, become background characters across the book. So you can read it as short stories, or you could read it as a bit of a novel. And I particularly like Paul Theroux because he's this kind of ancestor of Graham Greene, really, and I like this foreign settings, which, you know, you'll find out about in my stories.
Okay, so should we have your first piece of music and then we'll introduce you properly?
It's Ed Harcourt and Hay Wired.
Yes, this has been really a joyous recent discovery. I read a review of this album, kind of album in the week in the paper. It's probably 2 or 3 years old now. Never heard of Ed Harcourt, but it got rave reviews. So I got hold of it, listened to a couple of tracks, and it is just a wonderful album. And he's got a very interesting voice. And being a writer, I have to have interesting lyrics. I can't just have a lovely melody or tune. It's got both. And I particularly like this because there's a line in it goes that the self-destructive don't believe that there's a love they can leave. I think we've all been in certain relationships where we know that it may be not the right one, but it's very hard to convince yourself to get out of it. So this is, I love this track.
You're listening to Book Night on Cambridge 105, and we have André Mongeau in the studio. André has published 2 poetry collections, Natural Causes and Mixer, as well as 2 books of short stories, A Little Javanese and True North. True North has been long listed for the Frank O'Connor and Ed Chill prizes, and he's also had lots of other prize-winning stories, included in Bridport, Wigtown, Scottish National. André is also a member of the Joy of Six, a performance poetry group who have appeared in many festivals across the UK, Wales and New York. Fantastic. And André's work has been compared with the likes of Raymond Carver, Graham Greene and John le Carré. How does that feel when you get compared to writers like that?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I don't take it literally, but it just tells me that I'm on the right path, because those are definitely writers that I was interested in when I was younger. And hopefully I've started off probably imitating, and then hopefully I've found my own voice.
Absolutely. I think imitation is a key, isn't it, to finding your voice. And was there a moment when you were reading any of those authors or any other authors where you just suddenly thought, I have to do this, I have to, you know, rush off on my computer or grab my pen and write?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, I've had that since I was a little boy. Whatever I've read, I've gone off and copied, really. When you're a kid, that's what you do. Absolutely. No, and I suppose the most important thing isn't stylistically with those writers, it was the territory they were exploring, which most of it, to me, the interesting parts were abroad. And so I've kind of, from a young age, wanted to see what's over the horizon and get away from what's familiar, and find stories in the unfamiliar, both location and character.
Yeah, I mean, place is a massive part of your work. You've talked before about wanting to explore different places, particularly in your short stories, with different, you know, different location for every story. I mean, are you really well travelled? Are you always with a pen in hand when you're travelling?
Yeah, absolutely. I've done less travelling since I got married a few years ago, and it's kind of settled down and got a steady job and things. But when I was single, I did a lot of travelling. I tried to find jobs that would enable me to earn a bit of money, and then I could just give them up, kind of, day jobs, and then I'd set off on my own. It's very important to travel alone. Things happen, opportunities arise, you can just go with them. So I did a lot of that in my 20s and 30s.
Can I just ask you, because I was looking at your list of jobs on your website,
right,
and there's factory worker, dusterman, and caddy on a professional golf tour.
Yeah.
How did you get that?
Well, that was another thing. I've always been really sporty, and as a kid I thought, well, you know, I'd love to be a professional sportsman, and football, golf, tennis, they were all kind of options, I suppose, and golf was the one that I was most proficient at. Once I kind of established that I wasn't quite good enough to make a living out of it, I still wanted to have a bit of fun travelling and to get to know the professional game better, so I just went with a local golf professional who was kind of auditioning. You have to go through various qualifying tournaments to get on the main tour, and he did. So I started off with him 1 year in the early 90s in Dubai, and off we went. And so I did it for a year and a half.
Brilliant experiences that you can use in your writing.
Well, yes. Very strangely, I have. I've written a couple of poems about it. I haven't written a story about it. I do have a golfing story in True North, but it's not based on that caddying year. But it was a fantastic experience. I've still got a lot of mates out there.
So it's almost like you've got this sort of bank of experiences that you can now draw upon. Are you hungry to go out and travel?
Well, I'd
more?
Love to do it again. I mean, I've travelled most recently, which is a few years ago now, but I'm basing my current novel I'm writing in Romania. I went to Romania about 6 years ago, and that's really what I've been working on since. And because I have a day job, it's taken a long time to get it going, but I'm well into it now, and I'd like to do more, really.
Okay, well, we'll come back to the novel a bit later. First of all, we're going to go to an interview with K.D. Trevelyan from the Cambridge Writers, who I met with last week. The Cambridge Writers have recently published an anthology of short stories, and so I was talking to her about that. And I also started off by asking her how the group works.
We have a poetry group, we have a short story group, we have a children's writing group, a travel group, and a long prose group, i.e. novels. They meet monthly on different nights, and everybody's encouraged to either read their own work or ask for help, perhaps with a synopsis. But the whole ethos is to give constructive criticism so that people can help move on with their writing.
Okay, so each week will every member bring some work, or is it two or three people a week or something like that?
Usually the way the groups work, and it's up to each sort of writing, so the poetry group work in perhaps a slightly different way because their group tends to be slightly smaller. The long prose group is divided into three groups that alternate, and we keep each other up to date by email with a synopsis of what's read, so that if you then meet someone in the group the following month, you then are up to date with where they are in terms of their work. We also have talks that anybody from the public is welcome to come, which are held each month at the Hartington Grove Quakers Meeting House. And if you're a non-member, it costs £3. And there we invite a number of writers that you yourself, some of you've interviewed. But we have a different speaker each month. And we also occasionally run workshops. So, for example, late last year, we ran an e-publishing workshop for people who'd like to self-publish. And we're going to run another one of those later on in the year.
How many members have you got?
At the moment, I think we've got 81 members.
Wow, so it's alive and well.
Yes.
And it's been going for a long time, hasn't it?
Yes, since just after the Second World War it started. It was called the Cambridge Writers' Circle. And in 71, it changed to the Cambridge Writers. And they can be found at cambridgewriters.net if anybody wants to have a look and see when our meetings are held.
Okay, and recently you published an e-book. Do you want to tell me about that?
We did. Every year we run a short story competition for members only. And we had 34 submissions this year. And then we ask an independent judge to come in and who very generously reads them over the whole of January, I think. And then we announce the winners at the end. And there's a first, second and third, and then three highly commended. And this year, because we're able to self-publish, we decided it would be a good idea to actually publish it as a short anthology online, and it's worked terribly well, and it's another way of actually helping the members that want to publish their work.
Are you encouraging your members to sort of look at e-publishing, digital publishing? Do you think it's the way forward?
I think it's certainly something that should be considered. It's not right for everybody. It requires a lot of effort, and certainly the workshops we've run, it's not just about producing your work and throwing it up online and hoping someone's going to buy it. So there's a lot of consideration for marketing, PR and editing. You know, it has to go up in a, we feel it should go up in a decent state. You also have to consider covers. And also in terms of genre, I think with e-publishing, one of the good things is you don't have to sit in one genre. For example, we have somebody who, Thierry Etzel, who's published a book that really is a philosophical cybercrime, and that's kind of difficult to fit in. It's a great book. So I think publishers generally want to know which section to put them on the bookshelf in a shop. I think for people that aren't absolutely hard and fast in one genre, it's certainly helpful. Some of our members who've actually ended up being offered a deal stopped in the end. We also have another guy, James Grenton, who's produced several thrillers now and is quite happy and doing particularly well, really.
So just selling online and getting absolutely the Amazon reviews. And
yeah, and in the US and in the UK. So so for some people, it definitely works. We have another member who is being published by Canadian e-publishing company Harlequin, who also own Mills and Boone, and she does romantic history. And Joss Alexander had her book published by the Carina Press as a publisher, and it's only being e-published.
Oh, okay.
So I think it certainly should be considered, and certainly with the growth of tablets and Kindles, it would be foolish not to consider.
Because I think in the past, people sort of viewed it as vanity publishing, didn't they?
Yes.
And just a way of, like you say, throwing yourself out there and hoping for the best. But yes, it's about the way you do it.
Absolutely. And we all know that, you know, 50 Shades of Grey started that way. And then it's certainly a way of getting yourself seen. Mm-hmm. Hannah Hooten, who's one of our members, she writes racing romances. And she does particularly well online, although the racing stories of the UK, and she lives in Newmarket, obviously.
Yeah.
The US seem to be really interested, and she's, you know, absolutely factually correct about her racing, mm-hmm. and they seem to be enjoying that. So those writers within the group have made a conscious effort to explore e-publishing, seem to be doing very well, but it is a lot of hard work, and I'm sure they'd be quite glad when they get a bit more successful to hand over certain aspects to
Exactly, but it's just another route, I suppose, rather than just waiting for that agent to pick you up. So tell us about some of the people we can find in the e-book, the anthology.
The person that actually won is Alice Turner, who quite deservedly so did win. She's also being published on a teen fiction book in September. The story by David Franks that came second is based on a Greek myth but brought up to date very eloquently and beautifully. The third prize was Rick Gamick, and that again was a murder story but told in a slightly different way. Those that were commended, Will Tate, A Chapter of Accidents, which is quite amusing. He's somebody who, Will's writing is always interesting. Then there's Three Little Piggies by Stephen Hammond, which is a just fantastical tale, quite mind-blowing and hilarious. And then myself, I also came in on highly commended and thank you very much with a story called Laces, and that was concerning a rites of passage of a small girl when she learns how to deal with being left-handed. I also would just like to thank our judge, who's Jeff Malkovich, who is head of English studies at Robinson College, who was wonderful and really did read all of them because of the notes he gave us all afterwards was really helpful.
Brilliant. So a real range then. And people can get this by going on Amazon, is that right?
Yes, if they go on Amazon, and it's Cambridge Writers Short Story Competition 2013.
So that was KD Trevelyan there talking about Cambridge Writers' new e-book. And also just to say that that book, all the proceeds go to Talking Books of the Blind. So definitely go on there and take a look at that. And also to mention that if you go to Cambridge Writers' website, which is cambridgewriters.net, there's a full list of their programme of workshops and talks that are coming up. For example, they've got Anna Whitlock, who is going to be on this show, and they've got her in December. So pop along to them as well. Just to pick up on some of the things that Karen was saying there, Andre, about so what's your view on publishing online like that?
Well, I mean, it's exciting opportunity. It's opening up opportunities to writers now that have never been there in the past. And I think, as Karen was saying and you were saying on the interview, I mean, it is another way of potentially getting your foot in the door and getting people aware of your work. I mean, I would still go myself down the line first of seeking an agent, getting an established publisher, because of all that comes with that, in your help with marketing the book, a recognised brand, you know, the possibility of more than one book deal. But if you can't and you've tried that, then it's clearly a way to go. Kindle audio books, spreading the word through social networks. It's amazing, really, now how quickly people can learn that you're working on something, and if they pick up on it, well, sky's the limit, as we know.
Do you think there's a respectability about it now that there wasn't in the past?
It's getting that way, isn't it, now? I mean, people realise it's extremely difficult to find an established publisher and to do it that way for a new writer. And particularly, it depends what you're writing. If it's crime fiction and you're good at it, I mean, there are going to be loads of people knocking your door down. If it's literary fiction, it's extremely difficult. I don't know what the figures are. It's probably like 0.1% of people who are submitting books have not been published before in book form are going to get a contract. So it is hard.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting what she was saying about genre, I suppose, if you're a, what was it, a cyber something?
Philosophical crime.
It's like, yeah, if you're unusual and you're not easy to put into a category, then perhaps it is the way forward.
Yes, I mean, I think it's the I've gathered from submitting previous novels, it's the marketing department, not the editor, who decides whether the book's going to be published.
Where to put you, yeah.
And if they can't work it out, then however much the editor likes it and fights for it, you're very likely to get a rejection.
And I suppose that doesn't apply to short stories, does it, in that short stories are the genre? Or does it break down further that there are fantasy short stories?
No, I think you're right, but there the difficulty is space on the shelf and the fact that publishers don't tend to like to launch people with short stories. You're very fortunate if you do get that, and one or two writers I know have had that because they're exceptionally good with short story form. But they all want a novel. And then if you succeed with a novel and you begin to establish a bit of an audience, they're very happy to bring out a book of short stories, which is a bit frustrating.
And what was your route to being published?
Well, poetry, it was, how was it? I mean, back in the 80s, 90s when I was writing my first novel, a couple of novels. I got some interest from agents and publishers that didn't quite happen as novels. I'd written a book of kind of not self-published. I worked for an educational publisher, and they published a book of little poems that I'd written. But that was very local and small. Then I did this travelling, a lot of travelling in different parts of the world, and out of those I did start writing short stories. I submitted some of those to different magazines, and one that was quite well known and well established was called London Magazine, edited by a guy called Alan Ross, where William Boyd and a lot of other writers had had the first work published. And so when he liked them and started corresponding with me and said, "Oh, you've got to come and meet me and have lunch."
Brilliant.
And it was like, wow, at yeah. least somebody likes what I'm doing. And yeah. he said, stick with it. That was great. But the stories, I submitted them as a book, but nothing happened with them. And the publishers were saying, you know, we want novels. But actually, in the end, I ran out of material. And I thought, you know, what I was writing about was bitingly dull as far as I was concerned. It was kind of very domestic, and it was very suburban, and it was very English. And I thought, I need to broaden my horizons. I need to forget about getting published, and I need to live my life. And I started getting some of these quite strange jobs, the dustman, the factory worker, in order to meet people I would not have met before, and also to travel and saving up some money and then just backpacking. And off I went, and out of that came many more stories, which eventually, I'm wittering on. I'm aware of that.
No, it's interesting.
So I thought I was a fiction writer and a novelist or a short story writer. But when my first marriage broke up, which is probably about 15 years ago now, I started writing, splurging a lot of stuff out about frustrations and anger and lack of understanding and why things had happened. And when I got through all that, I started discovering that what I'd written, without really realising it, were quite a lot of poems. And when I sent those off, a lot of people liked them, and I got published a lot in magazines. I won some competitions. And then I had the sort of very difficult moment where I thought, well, maybe I'm not a novelist at all. Maybe I'm a poet. And that was quite frustrating in a way, because I knew immediately, well, that's all very well, but you're never going to make any money. And you're never going to make a living. But through getting my name known a little bit in the literary world through poetry and doing some festivals and getting two books published, I then, when Salt, who were an established poetry publisher, started, and they were local in Cambridge at that time, saying, we're looking for short stories, I thought, oh, well, I'll dig out these short stories, sent them off, they liked them, and those are the two books that came out in 09 and 010. And having got those out, I thought, well, and I had to write three new stories to fit in with the books they wanted. And so I was back into fiction, and now I'm working on a novel again. So I've kind of got both hats on now.
And I know you're going to read some poetry for us later, but we're going to listen to some more music first. It's Cherry Ghost this time. Thirst for Romance.
Yeah, well, I hope we never lose sight of the fact that we all want some romance in our life. This was a discovery. I didn't know about Cherry Ghost until about 5 or 6 years ago. Sampled this album, and it's just an amazing series of songs. Simon Aldred comes from, I'm not sure if it's Stoke or somewhere up north, and it's full of fantastic lyrics about the factories, his parents and grandparents. Beautiful melodies, and this is the title track, Thirst for Romance, which is exceptional.
Remember me with the wind in my night nurse that sits at my bedside, with a whistling heart that plays piano in the dark and cheers you every step of the way.
Listening to Book Night on Cambridge 105.
Yes, hello, welcome back to Book Night with Lee Chambers and Alex Rouget and our studio guest André Mongeau. And André, you're going to read for us now.
Okay, fantastic, I will. Because I do poetry and fiction, I thought I'd do a very quick poem and then I'll read maybe the first page of a short story. I do, as well as kind of serious poetry, which I've published, I also do quite a lot of performance poetry. I think this would fall into the latter category. It's the story of my life to date in hopefully 52 seconds, and it goes like this. Biography. Newborn, howling, Gloucester, winter, growing, crawling, running faster. Prep school, cold showers, cricket, soccer, choir boy, quiet boy, head boy, failure. Train ride, Moorland, big school, Yorkshire, monk priest, sixth form, no girls, rugger, Oxford, English, golf blue, loner, London, no job, Suffolk, dolor. Uncle, windfall, cottage, writer, girlfriend, East End, big spend, over, dustman, factory, caddy, searcher, cleaner, carer, dishman, worker. Novels, stories, journeys, teacher, new girl, actress, glamour, theatre, drinker, older, harder, weirder, shake up, break up, stranger, wiser. Russia, Java, restless, mover, notebooks, scribblings, patterns, order, poems, pain hooks, published, purer, meeting, marriage, mortgage, curer. 50, flat out, franker, feebler, artist, autist, stepdad, dreamer, west road, east road, fast road, sped it, checked in, book night, sat here, read it.
Thank you. We got a name check.
I know.
And I'll... this is the opening of one of the stories in True North, a collection that came out a couple of years ago. And this one is set in the Moroccan Sahara. And I'll start at the beginning and it'll just give you a flavour of going into that kind of setting. Tagine with Madonna. They call Makran an oasis, but to her it seemed like a dead place. Eve shielded her face from the spiralling sand as the jeep drew away. Even through her dark glasses, the alley was pink in the dusk. Bending forward, she picked up her bags from where the driver had dumped them. He'd muttered something in French that sounded like Pension Gérard, then with a sigh spelt it out. Presumably he'd stopped somewhere near, though from the unbroken mud-red walls that rose on each side of her, there was no means of telling. And no one to ask. The narrow street was deserted. Just then, along it, she noticed someone, a diminutive, white-robed man, his face very dark. Leaning casually in a doorway, he examined her fixedly. Sudanese, she told herself, walking forward. Even this small observation helped ease her headache, reassured her that for this assignment her research had been thorough. In fact, she saw now, the man was not small. The entrance where he stood was two steps down from the street. The deep shadow behind him made her think of a burrow dug in the sand. From it came the oily smell of meat cooking. Somewhere a sheep bleated mournfully in the dry, still air. Pardon, monsieur, je cherche, but a sharp human cry cut her short. She turned, heard a series of yelps and squeals. Through the fiery veil, still suspended where her taxi had been, a pack of small children came hurtling towards her, waving and shrieking. Before she had time to react, she felt a tug on her arms, looked back to see yet another infant, a barefooted boy with blue-black hair shorn close to his skull, hurrying through an arch which lay opposite. Her two bags swayed beside him, almost dragging the dirt. To keep sight of her things and escape the oncoming horde, she pursued the child without thought. At the end of the passageway, she spotted him, holding open a thick wooden door. Reinforced with black studs, a small grill at eye level, it was like entering a prison. The door closed behind her, and she heard a bolt drawn across.
Thank you, Andre. Well, lots to ask you about there, but we'll go to an interview first. Mena Van Praagh's first two novels, Men, Money and Chocolate, and Happier Than She's Ever Been, were self-published. Both garnered a worldwide readership and were translated into numerous languages. Her third novel, The House on Hope Street, was bought by Penguin and published in April this year. Earlier this week, I went on her trail. It's a sunny day in Cambridge, and I'm here in Market Square on the trail of best-selling novelist Mena Van Praagh. She's in a small kiosk called Taste, selling falafel. Who'd have thought you'd find a best-selling novelist there? Hello, Mena.
Hi.
Shall we go for a hot chocolate?
Certainly, sounds good.
Mena, it seemed appropriate to interview you in a cafe because cafes and hot chocolate indeed feature largely in your books. You're a big fan of both.
Yes, that's very true. A cafe, I suppose because I've worked in so many cafes and I love food, my husband's a chef, so food always features very heavily in my books.
Now your first book, Men, Money and Chocolate, can you tell me how that came about and what inspired you to write that?
Yes, well, as I say, I've been working in cafes ever since I graduated and I always wanted to be a writer. And it's a book about a waitress who wants to be a writer, essentially. So it was very much taken from my real life.
And suddenly that book went global. How did that happen?
Well, I self-published it first and I actually took it to a publisher who rejected it, saying that they had similar things. And I looked at their list and I thought, no, you don't have similar things. So in a sort of unusual, rather courageous move, I decided to self-publish it and show them that it would sell. And then I spent about 6 to 9 months taking it around bookshops in Cambridge, London, Oxford, begging and persuading people to sell it there, put it in their windows. Sometimes I bribed them with chocolate flapjacks and that kind of thing. And then, you know, occasionally I get lucky. I got a fair amount of rejections, you know. But, for example, there was a girl in Borders in Cambridge when Borders was still there, and she fell in love with it. And she sold 50 copies all by herself in a month just because she told every single customer to buy it, which was lovely. So I got, you know, some support, but a fair amount of not. And then I went back to that same publisher and showed them what I'd done, and then they took me on and published it. And they said, I think because, you know, publishing industry is such a cutthroat business now, and it's rather hard to get a book published, and they said if I hadn't have done that myself, they wouldn't have taken me on. So that was very interesting, because people are often quite sniffy about self-publishing. But I think in this day and age, things have changed.
And it's been translated into how many languages now?
26.
And your second novel, Happier Than She's Ever Been, that continues the story of the central character.
Yes.
And the central character is a waitress, works in a coffee shop, wants to write. I mean, as you say, clearly autobiographical. So you mined a lot of your own life as content for the book. Is that right?
Yes, in all honesty, I would say so. Especially the first one. The first one, I cut and moved things around in order to create a proper character arc and that kind of thing. But essentially, almost everything that happens in the book happened to me. Hence, I wrote the book in a couple of weeks. It was very much something that had been brewing inside me for about 4 years, and I knew I wanted to write it before then, but I had to go through the experiences, because it's very much a book about having courage and believing in yourself. I always think of it as sort of a little novella, you know, it's a bit of a fable, and it's very much about my life. And so many, especially women, have written to me from all over the world saying that it's about their lives too, which is incredibly gratifying. Yeah.
And May, in the book, she sees her novel as a kind of self-help manual, really, for women. Is that how you see them?
The first two books, yes, there's definitely an aspect to that. They're not, that's why I don't essentially think of them as novels. They're very much, they're sort of, the alchemist for women is the way I think of them. So, you know, these little fables that can help you if you want to achieve something in your life, or you feel something's missing, or, you know, they can just give you inspiration. And now, those were just two books that I needed to write for myself. You know, when you have something inside you and it just needs to be said. And now I've done that, I write just straight fiction. It still has an element of inspiration in it. But my latest book, The House at the End of Hope Street, is pure fiction.
And are there very strong female characters in that? Because I noticed in the first two novels, there are some really strong women in there who offer lots of advice and wisdom. Have you carried that idea through into your third book?
Yes, absolutely. It's about a house full of women, in fact. And one of the main characters, Peggy, she's in her 80s, and she's sort of the mother figure in the book, and she owns the house. And the house attracts women who've reached the end of hope in their lives. And it's about these sort of four women who live in the house and the tragedies that have befallen them, and then how they transform their lives.
Did you see women as very much the heartbeat of what's happening?
I think essentially I write about them because on some level I'm writing always about myself in a way. I'm certainly very fascinated by men. There are a lot of men in the books as well.
Because there's a philosophy that seems to run through them all. Is that your philosophy of life?
Yeah, I would say so. I said to someone the other day, I always write happy endings. And
you spoilt him.
Yes, well, you read one and then you know, my books are, you know, I take something sad and then turn it happy at the end.
You run this stall in the marketplace and you're a mum. How do you combine all of that with being a writer?
Well, my husband runs the stall. I did for the first few years when it opened, because we were working on it 24/7. But after the house at the end of Hope Street sold to Penguin, and that was when I was able to write full time. But it did coincide with the birth of my son. So when they sent me the edits for the book, it came on the day after my son was born. And I remember getting the text through, and they said, "Oh, what are you up to right now?" They knew my son was due, and I said, I texted back a picture of him to my publisher and said, "This is what I'm up to right now." And then I had, I think in my memory it was about 6 weeks to edit the book. And those were a very sleepless time. And I'd write edits at 3 o'clock in the morning and then read them again the next day and think they make no sense whatsoever.
But people often compare producing a book to producing a baby.
Yeah.
Did you feel the similarities then?
Yes, because my first two books were so easy to write, and I didn't feel that at all. I mean, they came out very quickly, but the Hope Street took about 2.5 years, all in all, and it was, yeah, it definitely was a labour of love. Giving birth to my son took 26 hours, that felt like 2.5 years sometimes.
And what are you writing at the moment?
Well, I've just finished the next book to follow on from Hope Street. It's not a sequel, but all my books are set in Cambridge, and I always pick a different part of Cambridge in which to write about. And this one is set in All Saints Passage, because I just find that street rather magical. I always think you can just almost walk past it and not realise it's there, and then you wander down it and has these tiny little shops. And when my husband and I were dating about 15 years ago, it had a little chocolate shop. He used to go there every week and buy me chocolates from there. So we got to know it quite well. And it's about a fictional dress shop and a bookshop on that street.
And as I say, there is a strong philosophy in your books about life pulling you through and taking you to a destination. So what do you think life holds in store for you in the next 10 or 20 years?
Gosh, I wish I knew that. Yes, one of the characters.
Why don't you shut the door and close?
It will happen to people. I just hope that I can keep writing. Being a mom and being a writer, it's sort of a perfect combination, because you can write whenever you need to.
That's Mena van Praagh there. I want a coffee now. I hope you could hear over the sounds of cappuccino being made in the background there and aromi. We've got André Mongeau in the studio. As your name suggests, André, you got a French background. Has that always made you very conscious of language and words?
I don't know if that's where it came from. I'm not even really bilingual, actually. I mean, I got this name because my paternal grandfather was a French violinist. I inherited obviously an artistic side from him, I think, and my uncle was a journalist and a writer. I suppose I have a facility for picking up languages, but I'm not, you know, sort of fluent in any of them really.
Can I just ask you, André, about your process and your sort of starting point for stories? Do you start with character, or do you always start with place?
I do tend to start with place, particularly obviously if I'm travelling and looking to set something abroad. As I said earlier, I like places that are unfamiliar, to try and just sort of land there and immerse myself in the place and absorb and see what happens. Because if everything around you is pretty unfamiliar, what you're looking at, what you're hearing, who you're meeting, then every moment becomes very vivid, I find. And the location, the story, the characters kind of emerge. You get ideas very quickly about settings. But I think settings are very important, and everything grows out of that. And if the setting works and is authentic, then the story begins to seem very authentic too.
So you say your novel is set in Romania that you're working on at the moment. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
I'm quite reluctant to, really, because simply because I've talked quite a lot about it in the past, and it hasn't, nothing much has happened with it because of the day job. But it's what I will say is that it's set against the background of trying to find out what's happened in Romania since Ceausescu, and particularly with the social sector and the orphanages, because of course that's what hit people a lot when the revolution happened and the TV cameras went in and had these appalling pictures of children in orphanages and more like prisoners than being treated well. So I went there with that interest in mind a few years ago, and obviously a lot's changed, but not everything has changed completely. And this was about 18 months before Romania and Bulgaria were due to join the EU. And I think they were still being pushed quite hard on social issues and on other things, corruption and border controls and things. But I was particularly interested in the social side. So I kind of developed, having stayed in an orphanage, I was very lucky to get that entry into there with a school party that was going over there. And having absorbed all that, I kind of, a story began to come to me about what if the final regulations were not being met, and would the great super tanker that was moving towards joining the EU be able to be turned around because one or two people put in reports saying they're not ready for this? And so out of that, a story grew, and it became then a love story and an adventure story and a missing child, and all kinds of things went into it.
Wow, it sounds amazing. So that must have been an incredible experience, going into the orphanages. So when was that? When did you
That was 2005. So as you can see already, I mean, since this novel still isn't finished, that it's had a very difficult gestation period, and I've made a few false starts. And I've seen one. I had an Arts Council grant to help me go out there and to fund also a mentor, an established novelist, too. Because in my first two novels, I felt were well written, but maybe the story and the narrative drive wasn't sustained, and I needed to make sure I didn't make those mistakes again. So he helped me with one or two false starts, and now I know I've I'm well on. I'm probably about halfway through it, and I'm well on the track, the right track now.
Just need to find the time.
I need to find the time to finish it. Yeah. And I really keep making myself deadlines, and I've got to hit them now.
And it's time for your last piece of music now, which is Underwear by Pulp.
Yeah, this was... it's hard when you've got three or four choices of your favourite tracks, and they're really ones I've been listening to recently. But the best of Pulp and the best of Paul Weller. It was a toss-up, really. it just reminded me of what amazing songwriters and lyricists there are, both of them. But Underwear, I like. It's sardonic. Jarvis Cocker is an absolute genius at this tone. And this is a love that you want desperately and a lust that you want desperately, but you're never going to achieve it, and someone else is going to get it. And it's just great.
Why don't you shut the door and close the curtains? Cause you're not going anywhere. He's coming up the stairs, and in a moment he'll want to see you underwear.
I couldn't stop it now. There's no way to get out. It's standing far too near. How the hell did you get me here? Semi-naked in somebody else's room. I'd give my
If fashion is your trade, then when you're naked, I guess you must be unemployed, yeah. But once it's underway, there's no escaping the fact that you're a girl and he's a boy.
I couldn't stop it now. There's no way to get out. He's standing far too near. How the hell did you get here? Semi-naked in somebody else's room. I'd give my whole life to see it. And just you stood there, only in your underwear. Come on, come on.
Pulp, the wonderful Jarvis Cocker there. We've got André Monjo in the studio. André, you flip between poetry and short stories. Is there something that poetry offers you that the short story doesn't, and vice versa? You know, which subject do you decide goes in which genre, as it were?
Yeah, well, as I've alluded to, by just, I don't know, fate or left brain, right brain, the fiction seems to come out set abroad. And a lot of my poetry is more familiar as far as set in this country goes, and just things I see around me day to day. And they have the similarity that they're both manageable in relatively short spaces of time and giving full-time job, etc. So they're a lot easier to get completed fairly quickly as opposed to a novel. But I'd say that that's the main difference. But I would, the similarity is that I'm definitely, and I started with writing stories, so I'm a narrative poet. They tell little stories, concise stories, even like biography, which I read. So I don't think they're complicated, difficult poem.
So it's interesting hearing you talk about yourself in the way you, well, I suppose we try to label you, don't we, when we introduce you as a short story and a poet, but you're obviously a novelist as well. And so you try
a writer.
A writer, yeah. You try to avoid giving yourself a label.
I don't really like that, really. Author or writer would do me.
And so now when you've got new ideas coming up and you know you've got to be getting on with your novel, are you trying to stop yourself from writing your poetry and your short stories, or do you just go with the flow?
I find that when I'm focusing on fiction and the novel, my mind is so into that I'm not getting the... I'm probably not actually seeing or hearing the things that would trigger little poems, quick poems. And once you get back into that, you just see them all the time on ads and TV, and you hear something, you know, and then I'm writing poems very quickly. And usually it's something in a poem that has a double meaning, and I think, oh, that's perfect, because it means this and then it means that, which I like in a poem.
And what's your writing routine? Do you have a
I wish I had a routine. When I write, it's always in the evenings. It's after work. I'm not one for getting up very early. I have to get up probably, I feel early enough to go to work, and then so I usually have a break. I go for a run after I get back, so there's a sort of physical, natural break, and then I have something to eat and will write, and hopefully late into the night.
And what is the day job?
The day job is I'm a fundraiser, a full-time trusts fundraiser for East Anglia's Children's Hospices based at Milton. So I've done that for 10 years.
Working in a hospice, you are surrounded by massive issues, literally life and death issues there.
Well, yes, I don't work in the hospice, but I fundraise for the hospice. I work next door to it. It's a very rewarding job. And, yes, I feel very fortunate. It does remind me how fortunate we all are, to be honest, with our lives. We moan about things, but... And I feel that too a lot of the time when I go off and travel and see people. It's like, oh gosh, we have it so good.
Mm. And your stories, because you're writing about issues, social issues, you were saying in your novel. So is that important to you?
I think it is. I don't want to hold myself as some do-gooder, I've always felt slightly outsider as a writer. I think a lot of writers would say this, and. I want to write about people who also feel outside something and shut out or left out through economics or any other social reasons. And I think those sort of characters seem to come up a lot in my fiction and in my poems.
The lonely voice, isn't it, that Frank O'Connor says that the short story is almost
designed
for the outsider, isn't it? It's their story that we're often talking about. And just very quickly to ask you about... go back to the market that we talked about before. I mean, are you still sending them out, your stories out to the competitions, and what do you think about these big prizes out there?
Well, a big prize is an extremely attractive magnet. While I'm writing the novel, I've got a couple of new stories that I've written. It's time, really. And I certainly am thinking of sending these out when the competition, the big ones, come up, the BBC and National Book Prize and things like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks ever so much for coming to the studio. Best of luck with finding the time to finish.
It's been a great pleasure. I'll just give one plug, my website.
Absolutely,
so if anybody wants to find out more about my writing, I have a website, and it's just booknight.com.
We can put a link to that on the Booknight website.
Definitely.
As well.
And thanks
definitely
a lot, both of you, very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're Booknight's taking a little break over the summer. We will be on every other Wednesday as usual, but there'll be older issues of the show. So if you missed the first time around or you want to listen to them again, then tune in alternate Wednesdays at 10 o'clock. And our first show in September is Poetry Special. We've got Grunt, a new poet, and visiting poet at the Scott Polar Institute and winner of the Crawshaw Prize, Caddy Bennion, and performance poets Faye Roberts and Luke Wright. Until then, enjoy your books.
Hello, it's Wednesday, it's 11 o'clock, and it is Cambridge 105, community radio for your city. And this show is Roots. I'm Harry Welburn. My thanks to Booknight. Roots is current, recent and historic world music, with a particular emphasis on Latino and American rural music like this. This is our featured artist for tonight. This is Rai Cuda. Great singer, guitarist and the unofficial musicologist of my adult musical life. The CD of the week is from the Spanish Harlem Orchestra, Un Grande El Barrio. Plus lots of Irish music. Let's get into Maria Elena. Rai Cuda from 1970s Boomer's Story. As I said, we've also got lots of Irish music, including tracks from Langston and the Pogues, plus music from Colombia, Palestine, Italy and Jamaica, and much, much more on Roots here on Cambridge 105. Thank you. more from Raikouta shortly en route, but here is the opening track from the double album Sing Me the Song, celebrating the works of Kate McGarrigle, Rufus Wainwright, Martha Wainwright, Anna McGarrigle.